dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight,
EOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton, Bealeton, KSOW, Cottage Grove, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, I asked listeners to email me with feedback on the show. Thank you so much, those of you who responded. So many of you told me about yourselves, what you're thinking and doing, as well as which of the topics covered on the show you find most interesting and meaningful. What thoughtful people you are. I feel honored that you lend me your ears. Some of the people who wrote suggested various things, including an unwelcome guest's discussion forum. Especially after reading your emails, it seemed to me that the people who wrote would definitely enjoy meeting one another, if only in virtual space, as you are literally all over the planet. A forum would be a good way to learn from one another and provide moral support. So I'm wondering if anyone out there would like to take on the project of setting up a discussion forum for listeners of the show on some platform that would not data mine people. That's the reason I don't have a Facebook page. Other people commented that they'd like to hear more practical information that would help people get free of the system and directly address solutions through their own actions. I agree completely and will work on providing that on the show going forward. In that spirit, I want to read you part of a letter sent to me by Charlie, who lives in Western New York. Charlie wrote, "I began listening to your show about 3 years ago after hearing one of your segments on the student radio station WRPI. I had a job with New York State Parks in Troy and spent 40 hours a week in a windowless laboratory following bureaucratic rules and doing trivial work. The people were nice and I made some friends, but the only perk of the job besides health insurance was that I could spend my 1 hour lunch break walking around the nearby park. What else can I say besides it was not what I envisioned life to be? It was stagnation. I began listening to your program regularly, and I felt like you were speaking directly to me. All the research I did showed how little I was taught in school, leaving out the context or teaching outright lies. And it angered me. This is a vast understatement. I began to see the impossibility of the system everyone subscribed to, but nearly everyone I talked with simply shrugged and said, 'That's how it is.' My wife and I talked constantly with each other about how there had to be more than this to living, and after a year, we'd formulated a plan. We saved up some money and paid off all our debts, quit our jobs, and moved to Western New York to try our hand at living on my family's farm. We've been here a year now, and our life is totally sweet, another vast understatement. We scrape to get by, but in all, we need less. Our time is our own. We butt up against the system regularly, but subverting the dominant paradigm is easier with each passing day. We garden for most of our food. We keep chickens and hunt. We're building our own house from materials on the land. And we're reaching out into this community with the goal of showing that a different path is not only possible but necessary for physical, emotional, and spiritual health. I talked with a hobo once in Troy about what I was learning of the world and its rulers, and he nodded his head with an understanding I never got from college friends or co-workers. This man told me that when you leave their system, you decrease their power. You deplete their numbers by one. He's right. I'm not helping this craziness anymore. I'm actively working against it and will continue to do so until things are in accordance with the natural world and when making your own life better doesn't mean someone else's life has to be worse. Thank you, Charlie, for that fabulous letter. If you haven't written, I'd love to hear from you. Email me at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.net. I'm answering every email I receive, so please be patient if you haven't heard back. Many people took the time to write very personal letters, and you deserve nothing less than an equally personal reply. This week on the program, we continue the Market is Naked series with a look at the discipline of economics itself. Is it a science, as economists claim, or is it a religion based on faith in an intangible entity, the market, with the power to transform the actions of innately greedy human beings into a socially beneficial activity? Our speaker this week is a professor of economics, though an unusual one. He does not assert economics is a religion. That's my encapsulation of his presentation. By a religion, I mean a belief system used to explain the world that is based on premises that must be taken on faith rather than evidence. The premise in question is the nature of human nature, and whether we have an economic/political system that responds to a reality we can't change, or whether it in fact creates a reality of greed and predation by inculcating and rewarding it every step of the way. This is a central question whose answer determines whether we take the attitude of Charlie's co-workers that this is just the way things are and get a prescription for Prozac, or whether we have the courage to grab hold of the fabric of the matrix and tear it to see what is on the other side. The talk I'm going to play was given at the Globalization of Homelessness and Poverty Community Lecture Series at Washington State University in Vancouver, January 27, 2005. The sound quality is not the greatest as it comes from a video camera, but it should be understandable nonetheless. So here is A Radical Blackfoot Teaches the Economics of Globalization. An event organizer will introduce the speaker.
Our guest speaker tonight was expelled from high school at the tender age of 16, then served in the U.S. Army from 1963 to 1966, which he says was a large factor in getting a real education. He is a member of the Blackfoot Nation and its traditional government, and he also holds citizenship in both the U.S. and Canada. For revenge, he became a professor of economics and went on to become a biographical subject in several marquee who's who's, including who's who in the world, America, the West, science and engineering, finance and industry, and as if that weren't enough, who's who in American education. He calls this, quote-unquote, a delicious piece of humor because of the unintended infiltration and subversion of one of the sacred institutions of the establishment by a radical renegade and anti-establishment Blackfoot. He currently holds the position of professor of economics at Clark College, as well as being a member of the Clark College Council and the chairman of the business division at Clark College as well. He holds undergraduate degrees in economics, sociology, geography, biochemistry, and mathematics statistics, as well as graduate degrees in economics, geography, research methods and statistics, and international law. He was recently invited to present a paper on the evolving concept of social capital, markets, market-based processes, and socialist construction at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Jim Craven.
hope you don't mind if I use the board. When I'm doing a subject, one of the ways that one of the heuristics that I use is I start with the topic or central concepts. And then what I ask people to do is to define. And then to talk about management or how do we conceptualize it. And then to talk about some of the causes. And then to talk about some of the effects. Now we've got two concepts to economics and globalization. Problem is, in neither case can I give you one definition. And this is why this subject is such a contentious subject. Because when we define, for example, economics, we have the right, the center, and the left. And they pose very, very different questions. They see different variables. They have different angles of analysis, different scopes of analysis, different core sources from which they cherry pick and data mine, and so on. For example, the right perspective, which is represented by the neoclassical perspective, that's what you're getting in most of your textbooks. Over 70% of textbooks in this country in economics are very, very conservative in their orientation. Why? Well, you're all in university, you should know that. Why? Already. It's called ideological cloning. When that's all you've ever been exposed to, that's what you pass on. You've never had teachers that turned you on to different points of view, then you don't know what those different points of view are to pass them on unless you're somehow curious and a little bit rebellious. If you're a graduate student, you've got to sing your advisor's tune because they're going to pass on your degree. You're not going to tell your advisor that their life's work is a bunch of crap. Okay? And then after you've done your fellowship and deals to get through, then you've got a cognitive distance issue.
You mean I was a whore all along too when I was a graduate student, huh?
So we get a lot of ideological cloning. The neoclassical, the focus of the neoclassical is on the micro. The neoclassical says we're all nothing more than a bundle of propensities. We're all really the same. Black, white, yellow, red, old, young, male, female, able, disabled, whatever, we're all driven by a bundle of propensities, tendencies, which they call economic man. We are by nature greedy, selfish, materialistic, acquisitive, rational, means we can figure out ends and means, calculating, we actually calculate costs and benefits in our lives. We are maximizers of pleasure and income and profit. We are minimizers, or at least satisficers, of pain, risk, and cost. We are economic machines. And so the conservative view sees globalization as nothing more than the unfolding of human nature on a global level. It's people. In other words, it's capitalism, it's internationalized capitalism, as it should be. Because the conservative view is what? What could be more natural than a system, rather than suppressing human nature, harnesses it through markets? A system, rather than trying to suppress our nastiness and our greediness and our viciousness, instead celebrates it. Greed is good. Let markets do what markets do. By the way, I should add parenthetically, whenever I'm at parties and people find out I'm an economist, they start giving me their pet theory. And usually their pet theory, which is from some bumper sticker they read somewhere, is, don't you think we should let markets do what markets do? Say, okay, I'll go up down with that, sure. If you can tell me the six things that markets do and the order in which they do them, we'll have a discussion. If you can't tell me the six things the markets do in the order in which they do them, then you're not worth my time. because you don't know even basics. I can't talk to you if you don't even know the basics. So the conservative view focuses on the micro, on the individual, as a buyer and seller of something. Okay? Whether it's labor power, whether it's loanable funds, whether it's land, whether it's capital. It focuses on the micro, and it says that it's the micro that makes the macro. In other words, the macro is simply nothing more than the sum of the micros. The whole is nothing more than the sum of its parts. The famous quote by Mrs. Thatcher is, there is no such thing as society. There's only an aggregate of individuals driven by certain biological propensities to maximize and minimize and satisfy. The whole is nothing more. And that's how you can tell a conservative textbook. You know how to tell? Which they start with. When they start with micro and then go to macro, they're probably neoclassical. If they start with macro first and then go to micro, they're probably institutionalist. If they critique capitalism at all, they aren't sold and they aren't published. Okay? So the neoclassical sees globalization and economics itself as nothing more. They see it as a science. They believe that economics is indeed a science, because there's a lot of math. Okay? Economics is for people who can do math. The whole focus then is on liberating the individual by what? By creating institutional arrangements through which the individual can play out their human nature. Okay? They can be. So in other words, when we get a dialysis machine, it's because why? Not because somebody wanted to make things better for society. No, what they wanted was prestige, status, promotions, grants, whatever. They're driven by old-fashioned greed. But out of that private old-fashioned greed, we get social benefits. Not even intended by the privately greedy. That's classic Adam Smith. Classic Adam Smith. Although a lot of the conservatives don't bother to read some of the other things that Adam Smith wrote, like his theory of moral sentiments, for example, where he says that there's not one occasion that businessmen get together that is not for the purpose of conspiring against the public in the form of restraint of trade and prices. But the neoclassical, the focus is on equilibrium. The system is seen as what? The system is seen, for example, as shocks causing changes in supply and changes in demand. It caused changes in prices, and then eventually caused changes in quantities demanded and changes in quantities supplied until we get a new equilibrium. So the whole focus of the neoclassical is moving from one equilibrium state to another in response to certain external shocks. What are those external shocks? These are called exogenous, meaning external to the system. Where do tastes and preferences come from? The neoclassical says, I don't want to get into that. That's squishy. That's for sociology, anthropology, disciplines people go into when they can't do math. Just jerking their chain. And so the neoclassical, to sum it up, sees capitalism as the highest possible system attainable. It is a system not only most consistent with human nature, but the system that what best allows human nature to play itself out. And out of micro chaos, you get macro stability. Sort of like string theory, that purports to be the bridge between quantum mechanics and general relativity. Out of the chaos on the micro level, people getting over on each other, doing each other, no, that's too much, no, that's too low. Out of the micro chaos comes macro what? Order, efficiency, the goodies of life. What about pornography? I used to work a long time ago, one of my jobs in my other life, I worked undercover in drug enforcement when I was in Puerto Rico. I never met a dope dealer yet that was a commie. Every dope dealer I've ever met was a born-again free enterpriser. They fit right in at the old Chamber of Commerce. Every pimp I ever ran into will tell you, I'm just doing free enterprise. I'm the middleman between supply and demand. I'm not going to get into morality. As long as it's legal, the neoclassical says, consumer tastes are sovereign. We can make no moral judgment. That's called a normative judgment, which economists are not supposed to make. Although we make normative judgments all the time, don't we? In terms of what we select, what we choose to look at, what we choose not to look at. One of my favorite exercises in class is to have students go to the back of the book and look at the index of the book and see what's not there. Sexism, you won't find it. Racism, you won't find it. Power, you won't find it. Imperialism, that word, you won't find it. Neocolonialism, you won't find that word. There are certain concepts that are definitely part of economics as a subject that you will not find in typical neoclassical textbook. Now comes the centrists. And the centrists are represented partially by neoclassical and partly by what are called institutionalists. And what they say is, yes, we have to start with the micro. And yes, the micro shapes the macro. But there's also a feedback here. Because the macro also shapes the context within which the micro occurs. So for example, right now we live in a real world of institutions, of value systems, of laws, of regulations, of constraints, all of which are designed to proscribe or to condition or to shape human behavior so that our behavior is more predictable. When you can predict behavior, you can manipulate behavior. You reduce transactions costs, you reduce information costs, you reduce all sorts of other costs. It's what it is getting everybody on the same playbook. That's why you start off going to school and you go to school to learn and you wind up learning how to go to school. You learn how to play the game. You learn how to survive. Hey? One of the exercises I also like to do in my classes is to test the hypothesis. Are we just vicious people? Because the centrist says that there's a relationship between the individual and the system. It's a two-way relationship. Yes, the system, individuals make the system, but the systems also shape the individuals in terms of the information available to them, in terms of value systems and tastes and preferences, distributions of income, right? Access to political power. I have a sign on my car that says, invest in America, buy a congressman. They go cheap. They're for sale, you know that. Like any other commodity, that's one of the things that markets do. The first thing that markets do is commodification, is to turn a product with potential utility into something for sale, something to be supplied and demanded that may command the price. That's job one of all markets. That's before anything else can happen. The product, the invention, has to be geared up to the level of innovation, an application so that it becomes a marketable product. And we can see that there's all sorts of possibilities, aren't there, of commodifying things. Dating. I mean, look at this, how many people are hooking up on the old internet now. It's wild. So the centrist says, yeah, there's a relationship between the individual and the system. And furthermore, there's a role for government here in terms of addressing some of the failures of markets. See, the conservative says where markets fail, there's one answer, more markets. That's the conservative answer. So if little Johnny, some company is polluting a river, and little Johnny is downstream glowing in the dark, the Swiss watch, the conservative says, well, hey, can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. And secondly, it creates profit opportunity for someone to clean up the river. One market creates another market. Plus, there's the funeral industry when Johnny dies. Then there's health care when Johnny needs some care. One profit opportunity creates another. The answer to market failure is more markets, just like the answer to failure of democracy is more democracy. This is the typical conservative argument. The liberal says, well, I'll go for that, but sometimes markets don't do what markets are supposed to do. Sometimes. And when they don't do what they're supposed to do, which is not only to commodify, the job number two is what? Is to determine price. Right? Job number three is to allocate resources. Job number four is to ration. Job number five is to provide information. There are information systems about relative prices of inputs and outputs. And the final job in clearing shortages and surpluses. That's what markets do. And that's the order in which they do them. Actually, first, commodification. Secondly, price determination. Thirdly, information. Fourthly, resource allocation. Fifthly, rationing. And sixthly, clearing shortages and surpluses. That's the six things markets do and the order in which they do them. And in doing that, they solve the what, how, and for whom questions of economics. What shall we produce? How shall we produce it? And for whom shall we produce? Those are the three fundamental questions of all economic systems. And there are three fundamental mechanisms through which those questions are posed and answered. One is tradition, as in the case of indigenous societies. Second is by command, in the case of slave and social societies and elements of capitalist societies. And the third is the market mechanism. Those are the three mechanisms, right, for posing and solving those questions, what, how, and for whom. Okay? So the centrist says, well, economics is, you know, is not just a study of individuals, it's a study of systems too. But primarily individuals. As they go about what? Buying and selling and doing what they do and posing and answering those three questions. But whereas the rightist says least government is best, unless it's defense contracts or intruding into your bedroom, ramming morality down other people's throats, when it's other than that, their mantra is least government is best. That those who govern least govern best. The centrist is more sophisticated. The centrist, like the liberals. My mom used to call liberals those whose hearts bleed with other people's blood. My mother was sort of hardcore. The liberals understand that if the system gets really way out of whack, and if the system doesn't deliver, people start asking all sorts of nasty little questions. They start reading Karl Marx or joining militias. They start getting very angry and very alienated. Like the bumper sticker says, if you think the system's working, ask someone who isn't. And that's why in economics, the concept of social capital is only a recent phenomenon. The conservatives barely recognize the concept. The liberals recognize it. Social capital, okay, the definition of economics of capital is anything that's been produced, right, and used to produce something else. Second kind of capital, this kind, human, intellectual. The third kind of capital, and I have a reason for introducing this distinction to you because of where I'm about to go. The third kind of capital is called social capital. And what that refers to is refers to institutions, relationships, value systems that are designed to foster hope, trust, cohesion, cooperation, and basically buying into the system. Because without hope, people don't save or invest or get an education, or do all those other things, sacrificing in the present for a future return. And so having hope is absolutely critical to the function of the system itself. And that's becoming increasingly recognized now. One version, by the way, of social capital, just to note parenthetically, is a very narrow definition. Social capital for the conservatives is basically arrangements of reciprocity. You do for me, I do for you. Rolodex, okay? Fixing jobs, networking, whatever. Okay? It's not surprising. We have a
somebody in the Oval Office right now who's never gotten one single job on his own. Not one. Without his family wealth and name. Not one. Check it out. It's called Affirmative Action for Rich White People. So the centrists see globalization and economics very differently. The conservative sees economics as a science focusing on the greedy individual and sees globalization as nothing more than the internationalization of market-based relationships, institutions, processes, and value systems. That is exactly what their literature says. The internationalization of capitalism, in a nutshell. And that's how it should be, according to that particular point of view. We're liberating people. Rising tide lifts all boats. Trickle down. Supply side. That's the mantra. The centrist says, well, first of all, we shouldn't just be focusing on the micro. We also have to look at the macro, too. And secondly, the centrist sees globalization more as a sort of an inexorable process of integration and interdependence on a global level that has capitalist aspects to it, but also non-capitalist aspects as well. The centrists are willing to deal with some of the non-capitalist stuff. They're willing to go into other disciplines like anthropology, sociology, political science, history, biology. They're willing to go into other disciplines and see that economists can be trained in those, and should in fact be trained in those other disciplines. Whereas the neoclassical, strict neoclassical says no. The neoclassical says economics is a science, it is self-contained, it deals with what economists deal with. We leave other concepts like racism, sexism, power to sociologists and anthropologists. We just don't deal with that kind of stuff. That's what the neoclassical says. And finally we get the left. And the left sees the micro-macro question very differently. The left sees the macro as fundamental to the micro, with some feedback that way. The leftist says that human beings have certain basic propensities, of course, to survive and eat and so on. But how they play out those propensities, and perhaps even transcend them, has a lot to do with the macro into which we're born. One of the experiments I like to do in my classes is ask a simple question. Does it make a difference if I'm grading on the curve? Well, think about it. If I grade on the curve, 10% have a chance of an A, the next 15% B, the next 50% C, the next 15% D, and the bottom 10% are doomed to an F. That's how a curve works. Okay? Now, if I were to grade on a curve, and let's say somebody missed class, would you share your notes with them? Wouldn't be very rational, would it? Maximizing the individual that you are? Huh? They could be using your notes to get one of them scarce A's? How about a study group? Would you have a study group that includes somebody who was a little slow in the subject, not as quick as you are? Probably not. It wouldn't be optimal, would it? You'd get the cream of the cream in your little study group. What about if somebody were cheating? Would you rat them out? Absolutely. Because on a curve system, when one person goes up, they automatically put others down. That's how a curve system works. Now, is it my system that's determined the behavior, or is it human nature? Well, the way to test that proposition is to switch the system and to see if you can switch in the behavior. So I do that. I say, I'm not going to grade on a curve. I'm going to grade on an absolute standard. 90 and above is A, blah, 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 right? In other words, I'm prepared to give all A's, all F's, or in between. Now do you have a disincentive to share your notes with somebody who missed class? No, because they won't be taking your scarce A, will they? Now do you have a disincentive to form a study group with someone who's not as good in the subject as you are? Yeah, because by teaching the subject, you really learn it. Because you have to break it down for others. And you have to be in command of the totality to be able to break it down, particularly in sciences. Some of the touchy-feely stuff, no, you can walk into class and hug and sing kumbaya and pass it along. But if it's a serious science with foundations to it, and you have to master the foundations at each step to move to the next step, like physics, like chemistry, like other subjects, then you have to be on your game. You have to know the totality and the steps toward into that totality. So teaching someone who's slow would be in your interest, actually. You see the point?
You're doing it now.
So that's the human nature question. So the left says that globalization is nothing more than neo-imperialism. That's it. You can call it what you want. You can label it what you want. You can play all sorts of games. But what it comes down to in the end is the globalization, the internationalization of imperialist institutions, power structures, relationships, value systems, and whatever. And the basic message of globalization from the neoclassical point of view is what? You people are backward because you're not like us. When I was in China, that was the message. You go to Wang Fujing, there's three McDonald's. Three of them within sight of each other in Wang Fujing district in Beijing. Three of them. You, from one you can see the other, from the other you can see the other right down the line. Yeah, you Chinese are backward. You don't have KFC. You don't have enough McDonald's. You don't have Nike. You guys need some more obesity, some more coronaries. Because Lord knows that we're superior. We're Americans. Just ask us. We can't take out a little country like Iraq, but we're superior. And the reason why you people are backward is because you're not like us. And as soon as you get with the program on a global level, as soon as you privatize those state institutions, as soon as you open up markets, reduce all tariffs and quotas, as soon as you follow our program for what's called conditionality, that means in order to get IMF loans and World Bank loans, there are conditions such as tight money supply and high interest rates to control inflation, which means high unemployment. So if there's any of you who are unemployed, thank you very much for helping to keep my prices down with your unemployment. Appreciate it. Ready? So one of the reasons why this is such a contentious subject is because of the perspective from which you're looking. 2 weeks ago, I was on a train to Browning, Montana. And as I got on the train with my partner, who's Blackfoot, the conductor said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Browning." He just looked at me, because he knows. He said, "That's no man's land. Why would you go there?" I said, "Well, because I have family there, and I have a cousin who's terminally ill." Oh. Globalization looks a lot different from the perspective of an Indian reservation in America than it looks from the glass office buildings of J.P. Morgan and the Chase Manhattan Bank. It looks a lot different. It's not noticeable there. It just goes on. It's the same thing for hundreds of years, the same story. Right? And so one of the other problems that we've got is the problem of paradigm. We have three fundamentally very, very different paradigms that pose very different questions, that see the world in very, very different terms, that use different data. They all cherry bomb. I mean, it's all of us cherry picked. I mean, that's the sin on all sides. Go to a textbook sometime. Just go to your textbook sometime and look at footnotes sometime. See how many of them are from the same ideological source. I could count on my four-finger hands the number of economists I've ever met that are seriously red marks. Seriously red marks. None of them. Well, that's passé. So, well, what do you mean it's passé? Well, you know, it's obsolete. Communism's over. What? Marx was an analyst of capitalism. He had nothing to say about communism.
He was an analyst of capitalism. You have to read Marx before you talk about what Marx said or didn't say. And on the left, I find the same thing. I find left-wing economists who don't read Friedman, both Milton and Thomas, and who don't read outside their ideological box. True believers. It's like religious people, same thing, never even read their own holy book, let alone the holy book of anybody else. I've met very few religious people who even read their own holy book, let alone the holy books of other faiths. But they'll all tell you, I got the truth. Just ask me. And the debate of globalization is a lot like that. Because one side says, look, it's inexorable. Capitalism, it is inexorable. That capitalism, because, you know, the basic thing is, it goes like this. Commodification through basic supply and demand gives rise to price determination. This gives rise to information about profit potential or utility potential. It's basic supply and demand here. And information then helps us to determine what to produce. And that leads us to help allocate our resources, land, labor, and capital. And that helps us then for rationing. Who gets the goodies? Capitalism's a very cruel system. You walk into a 7-Eleven, cute kid, say, listen, I have no money, but my kid's really cute. My kid needs milk. You're going to say what? You better have one of four things. You walk in. You better have cash, working Visa, MasterCard, practically your own. Food stamps with CNS and a gun. Because capitalism is about profit. Capitalism is about profit for power and power for profits. That's what capitalism is all about. It's about market share, about market power, it's about getting over. There are two golden rules under capitalism that have very little to do with the one in the Bible. One of them is those who have the gold make the rules. The second one is do unto thou's competitor what thou's competitor is likely to do unto thou, but do it first and do it worse. Preemptive strike. And from there, we help to clear shortages and surpluses. And from there, where do we go again? We go back to commodification. One other thing that's different here is the neoclassical point of view is unidirectional causality. In the neoclassical view, change in X causes a change in Y, causes a change in Z. There's ultimate independent variables, there's ultimate dependent variables, and there are intervening variables. The leftist says the opposite. No, the world is nonlinear. Perhaps run by some very linear people, so some very linear minds, the world is nonlinear. Because what happens is, this leads us back to what? Finding new commodities. Example, how many different kinds of potato chips are there today? I remember when there was only one kind. That was it. Just potato chips. That's it. Now you've got what? Taco this, cheeseburger that, super cheese, jalapenos. Lord knows what they got. It's called product differentiation. Now the question is, how does this drive globalization? Well, it's really, really simple in a way. And this is one of the driving forces of globalization. Let me give you another model, other than the economic man model, of why people do what people do under a market-based economy. See what you think, okay? When I first started studying economics a couple years ago, nobody ever gave me an answer why the theory assumes that capitalists must or will maximize total profits. Now, that's realized total profits, not just producing it, but realizing it. It means in the kitty. It means after you cleared the accounts receivable. Okay, that means in the bag. And the basic imperative is to realize maximum possible total profit. That was changed later on in the textbooks to not maximize, but satisfies. Good enough for government work. The question is why? Well, because if I don't, I must do this. Because if I don't, I lack the credit worthiness or the retained earnings necessary to widen and deepen the productive base or myself as a person. These imperatives govern each of us as individuals. They govern economic units like firms, government regulatory agencies even. Okay? So why must I maximize profits? Because if I don't, my competitor will. And if I don't and my competitor will, then my competitor has the what? Has the means, the retained earnings or credit worthiness to be able to accumulate capital, to widen and deepen the productive base of the enterprise, which you must do. Why must I continually widen and deepen my productive base? Because if I don't, and my competitor does, then my competitor is able to maximize productivity. In other words, maximize output per unit of input, or minimize input per unit of output. That's known, by the way, as technological efficiency. There's actually six forms of efficiency in conventional economics. And part of about globalization, by the way, is also what? Is the process of defining. Because as value systems spread globally from centers of dominance to areas of weakness, and as cultures spread, terms and definitions spread too. Efficiency, for example. Right? Most people think of efficiency as what? Doing more with less. Minimizing cost, right? And every textbook I've ever seen in economics says efficiency is good. More is better. They don't ask what it is you're producing and what inputs you're using. If you like efficiency, you'll love Auschwitz. You want to talk efficiency? They had it down. How to pile up more bodies per unit of time and per Reichsmark of expenditure. They were quite efficient, if that's what you mean by efficiency, without making any moral judgment, right, about what it is you're producing, as well as how you're producing it. So I must maximize profits. Why? Because if I don't, my competitor will. And if my competitor is able to realize profits and I'm not, my competitor has the credit worthiness or retained earnings able to widen and deepen the productive base. And if my competitor is able to widen and deepen its productive base and I'm not, then my competitor is able to what? Maximize productivity while I'm not. And if my competitor is able to maximize productivity and I'm not, then my competitor is able to effectively compete. My competitor can get his costs down, which means he can get his prices down profitably. And drive me out, either through price competition or through other forms of competition. If my competitor is able to effectively compete while I'm not, then my competitor is able to continually what? Realize more profits while I'm not. My competitor is doing what? Well, my competitor, by getting his prices down, is by getting his costs down, he's able to get his prices down. And he's able to increase sales and turn more sales into more customers and more customers into more sales. And he turned that into increased profits, which turns that into increased market power and name, market name. And then to turn that into more profits directly, that into more customers directly, that into more sales directly. That's capitalism in a nutshell. Why must I do this? Because if I don't, my competitor will. Just like if I go to the 7-Eleven and say, listen, I got no money, but my kid's hungry. Can you help me out? Get your karma out of receivership. That person's been trained in economics. You know what they're going to say to me? They're going to say, listen, I really like to help you. But there's a store down the street that's run by this total bastard. Absolutely ruthless. That is the borderline sociopath. And the problem is, if I give you that milk, my costs go up. My profits go down. And what's going to happen is he's going to eventually, making more profits, going to bring in new inventory, barcodes, all the rest of that stuff. He's going to capitalize his business. He's going to get EBIT's costs down even further. And eventually he's going to drive me off the block. And I wound up going out of business because I was trying to keep my karma straight. Now, the problem is, these core imperatives... These core imperatives give rise to derivative imperatives. For example, if I must maximize productivity, which means the same as what? Helping to reduce my total cost? What's going to happen?
Pay less.
Yeah. Why would I bother with American workers when Mexican workers have about, on the average, 80% of U.S. manufacturing productivity, but 1/9th the wage? Why would I possibly? And plus, there's a friendly government in Mexico. They don't mind a little pollution here and there. They're almost as corrupt as the one here. How about unions? Am I going to be thrilled with unions?
Mm-hmm.
So outsourcing. Temps. All flow from the core imperative to what? Produce at the lowest possible total cost. How about polluting a river? And it's cheaper to buy off a couple congressmen to get an exemption than to clean up the bloody river. What do you think I'm going to do? What if my competitor's a total pig and I'm a decent person? What's going to happen to me economically? You think my customers are going to come to me and say, yeah, we're willing to spend $200 more for this thing because Jim Crane is a good guy and he keeps his karma straight. He cleans up rivers, he pollutes. So we're going to pay a premium price so we can keep our karma straight. Sort of like the dolphin-free thing. How many people will do that? Most of the consumers, what? They're struggling. Two jobs. Limited incomes, right? Worrying about layoffs, whatever. They're looking for what? They're looking to maximize utility. They're looking to what? Cast their dollar votes where they can get the biggest utils, most utils per dollar of expenditure. How about strip mining? Or strip cutting? How about strip mining and clear cutting? If you're doing mass logging operations, you're going to sit and go around and carefully see which trees to cut, which ones you don't cut. Think about long-term sustainability? I don't think so. You want to get a whole bunch of logs out of there at the lowest possible total cost. What are you going to do? And suppose you're a logger who does have an ethic. Suppose you're, you know, an owl groping logger or, you know, tree hugger. What's going to happen to you when you start carefully looking at which trees you cut and thinking about sustainability? And you're up against some big, huge corporation that just clear cuts the crap out of a whole area. Who's going to win in the competitive race? See the point? How about this? Effective competition. This is about markets, right? This is about markets. It's about sales. It's about revenue shares. Markets are about what? About supply and demand. The neoclassical says, what I demand, as long as it's not illegal, it's no one's business. That's why libertarians, who are conservatives, are into pro-dope. They're into legalization of dope. Pro-choice on the abortion question. Even same-sex marriage stuff. The whole thing. Libertarian conservatives, can you imagine that? They're very conservative about markets and so on. Why? Well, they believe what? Least government is best is an absolute axiom. It means stay out of my morality, too. Unfortunately, they haven't seen crack babies because they argue that dope is a victimless crime, prostitution is a victimless crime. They argue it's nobody's business. So
So what about what we're demanding, and what we're demanding does to the person as a person? That's what's happening with globalization. That's what I saw in China. That's what with the warfare going on. Because another contradiction of globalization is what? Think about it for a second. If you folks here who are business majors, what would be an ideal customer for you? Huh? Somebody from the standpoint of profit for power and power for profit. Who would be your ideal customer? Somebody who's narcissistic? Yes. Self-obsessed? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because mm-hmm. those kind of people jump on fads. Mm-hmm. They buy. They haven't swished a condom butt or whatever. They'll pay big bucks to look like everyone else while they're being different. How about somebody who's rather calculating about cost and benefits? How about somebody who's unable to delay gratification? Somebody who wants it all and they want it now. And they're willing to run a little plastic to get it now. Mm-hmm. They're willing to pay 34% compounded for fries at the BK, whatever. Sorry, the water puts you over, but you can do fries. How about somebody who's greedy, selfish? You make some real bucks off of somebody like that. Here's the contradiction. Is that the kind of person you'd like to have with you in the military unit combat? Is that the kind of person you'd like to have with a next door neighbor when there's a flood? Is that the kind of person you'd like to have as a son-in-law or daughter-in-law? See the point? The kind of people we create through a demand and through what people buy is exactly the opposite kind of person we would want in another context, as a citizen, as a voter, as someone in a combat unit. And that's one of the contradictions in the social capital of capitalism itself. The value system that is necessary from the point of view of effective demand and profits and markets is another kind of value system, because it turns people into narrow, myopic, self-centered, narcissistic calculators. That's why some people believe that when the neoclassicals talk about human nature, what they're really engaging in is Freudian projection. They're describing themselves and laying it on the rest of us. More or less what Freud did. You know, I never had a thing for my mother, okay? Never had a coke habit, okay? Toilet training was uneventful, I believe. So some people think Freud's whole theory is a case of his own concept of projection. That may be with the conservative notion, too. The greedy, nasty, selfish people they're describing are themselves, and they're trying to lay it on the rest of us as part of human nature, that therefore they become normal. Now, these different views of economics and globalization lead to different prognoses. The conservative says capitalism has, wherever capitalism has been introduced, it has triumphed, because it's the best possible system among some rather unsavory alternatives. And therefore, wherever capitalism is left to go, and it will triumph. That is the neocon and conservative prognosis. It's in their literature, and so on. And they are prepared to do what it takes to make sure that happens. You know, logic is a funny thing. Like, A equals B, right? B equals C, ergo A equals C, right? That's a classical syllogism. Well, how about this? All birds are cats, and all cats are green. Ergo, what?
All birds are green.
Is that deductively valid? Yes, but it's pure crap. But now that